Many people, myself included, can get a bit stressed out when thinking about the realities of climate change. But we aren't the only ones experiencing climate-related stress. Unsurprisingly, climate change is driving animals to adapt in all kinds of ways, and they may even have mechanisms to prepare the next generation to deal with similar stressors that they deal with. Open your ears and your mind, and let's chat about that. Welcome to GriffinCast, a podcast where we casually chat about science coming out of the College of Biological Science at the University of Guelph and how that work can affect lives around the world. I'm your host, Amanda Reside. With me today is co-host Mackenzie Charter.
Hello, everybody.
And extra special guest, founder of GriffinCast and recent Guelph alumnus, Dr. Michael Lim. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you for having me, guys.
It's so great to be able to come full circle. Michael completed his PhD in Dr. Nick Bernier's lab, and today we'll be chatting about their recently published study, which examines the ability of mother fish to deposit certain biological molecules into their offspring as a result of environmental stressors. We'll be recording this 1 week after Mother's Day, so we almost got perfect timing. So, Michael, you've been on one side of this interview process before, and the audience is just dying to know more about your own research. So how would you describe your PhD research?
So I would broadly describe it as we're trying to uncover how you could transfer stress across generations and what that would mean in terms of how it affects your offspring. And then, of course, we sprinkled in a little bit of that climate change angle in terms of if we are exposing you to stress related with climate change, can your offspring be better adapted or not?
Very cool. Very cool. So when you were in your undergrad, or I don't know if you did a master's, but when you were doing your master's, did you expect to be looking at sort of transferring stress across generations, or how did you end up with that kind of a topic?
So I guess it kind of comes down to growing up in a time where climate change was kind of top of mind. And so you have this thing where like all your professors and your teachers and everyone going through like, you know, elementary school all the way up through university are talking about, oh, climate change is big. It's impacting everyone. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be up to you to figure out how to fix this problem that we've laid on your shoulders. And like, good luck.
I certainly feel the responsibility.
Yep.
So that kind of work is always kind of top of mind where I want to understand more about the potential impacts that all these, you know, educators growing up have hinted at and kind of warned you about. And so that in combination with kind of the work I've been leading up to this point. So for my undergraduate and my master's, I did research projects that looked at the impact of anthropogenic activities. So things like mining and like effluent coming off from nuclear power plants. So it's kind of almost like a natural progression to go through, okay, now we studied one specific life stage and I looked at eggs and that kind of impact for my master is like, why not we just combine those ideas together with the impacts of climate change into my own study, which is the whole benefit of having your PhD, being able to kind of have more of a say in what you want to study.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, was there any particular moment throughout that, you know, educational onslaught of climate change related warnings that really inspired you to like go on and take on the responsibility of grad school and a PhD?
I think, I'm not sure if I can speak for most people who did grad school, but I wasn't doing it for the sake of researching a specific thing. It was more about kind of getting those broader skills in terms of research and analysis. It just so happened that I ended up being in a stress lab and I could kind of mix my interests along with the expertise that was provided through Nick and all the other graduate students at that time. So it's one of those things where you, living in the moment, you don't think about it. But looking back, it's almost like, it's a clear progression of all the things I've been doing through my academic career that got to me at this point.
Hindsight is always 20/20.
Exactly.
Yes.
You and Dr. Bernier recently published a study titled Zebrafish Parental Progeny Investment in Response to Cycling's Thermal Stress and Hypoxia, Deposition of Heat Shock Proteins but Not Cortisol. To translate that a bit for our audience, let's talk about some of the overarching topics you covered. In a broad sense, You are studying how organisms can adapt to environmental stressors related to climate change. Specifically, you focused on fish and how they can adapt between generations to fluctuations in water temperature and oxygen content. Would you be able to explain how climate change affects temperature, oxygen, and any other aspects of the environment in aquatic ecosystems?
Sure. So when we say climate change, for most people listening, you might immediately think of climate change is global warming, period. And so you have that increase in temperature, so it's kind of a more easy, okay, if the general planet is warming, of course, water temperature is also going to increase. What's perhaps not so obvious is the impacts on oxygen. So there are, for example, the direct impacts of temperature on water chemistry. So just by the fact of the properties of water, at a higher temperature, you have less oxygen dissolved in the same amount of water. But the bigger factor here, more than just that, is the amount of oxygen demand. So that kind of comes back to, I guess, energy rates and rates of reaction. So to simplify that, let's say, imagine like an ectotherm thing, like say, like a lizard. And under warmer conditions, you might expect them to move around more and be a little bit more active, versus in colder temperatures, might slow down. So you have these generally reduced activity and oxygen consumption at colder temperatures because you're not doing quite as much. Of course, it's not as impactful to humans or other mammals because we're warm-blooded, but that's a whole other thing. So under high temperatures, you are having less oxygen being dissolved in the water, and you're also going to have a higher oxygen demand because you are having more activity and required to keep up with your increased reaction rates in your body. So it's this kind of stress that comes from not only reducing oxygen, but increasing what you need. As for other aspects of the environment, so climate also impacts all other things I didn't study in this study, such as, for example, impacts on acidity.
Of course.
So like carbon dioxide is that big greenhouse gas that you hear about all the time in the news when you talk about climate change. And so with increased carbon dioxide, you can add that more dissolve into water and create carbonic acid, which can dissociate the carbonate and hydrogen ions. So then we have that increased acidity. So that can also impact things like, you know, coral reefs and bleaching. But yes, there's a lot of multifaceted things that are working together impacting environmental systems.
Right. So you focused in your study specifically on temperature and oxygen content. And you also mentioned eutrophication as an environmental stressor. Can you just define for us what eutrophication is and how it's related to temperature and oxygen?
Sure. So eutrophication might be better known by as an algal bloom. So it's what happens when you have a lot of extra nutrients. This is usually temporarily in an aquatic body. And so you increase the amount of algae that grows in that environment. The problem comes is that with this increased amount of algae and can also have, say, increased amounts of other microorganisms, they consume more oxygen. And also when they die and decompose, it'll consume a lot more oxygen. So this creates these low oxygen environments and this kind of, I don't know, positive feedback almost, where you're creating a more severe environment to live in as more and more things die and becomes more and more severe. And you can create these like hypoxia or dead zones, literally, where anything that requires aerobic function would struggle to survive.
So your research is based on something known as the maternal match hypothesis. So would you be able to explain the maternal match hypothesis to us and how you used it to design your study?
Sure. So the maternal match hypothesis is just kind of one of many names this kind of phenomenon is given. And in fact, I would argue that the use of the word maternal is perhaps a little limiting and should perhaps be environmental, for example, or parental. But beside the point, it essentially involves the transfer of information from one generation to the next to help prepare them for future stressors. So in terms of designing my experiment, I was kind of interpreting the idea, sure, we might see an effect, but what is causing it? What is the actual information being transferred?
Interesting, and interesting how language is always changing and evolving, right?
Yes, especially in science.
So is this a phenomenon that is observed in more than just like outside of aquatic ecosystems, like in mammals or in humans?
Yeah, it's been seen across a lot of different species, especially those raised in lab in activity, like in mice, for example. Probably the most famous one in humans is one that I come across is survivors of the Dutch famine, where they had children and grandchildren with bodies of higher incidences of cardiovascular disease, obesity, and those kind of like diet-related things. And so researchers suggest that perhaps this is due to having offspring who are predicted to be exposed to low food environments. And so in contrast, when you're living in environments that have higher amounts of food, and or especially in like the more modern age, like fast food and everything, it's not as great for the bodies, which are expecting this kind of more, I don't know, nutrient deficient environment. Of course, you know, there's like a little extrapolation there, but it really comes down to that whole matching idea where it's really, really beneficial if it's a good preparation in terms of matching of what the parents are seeing, what your offspring are seeing. So you can't have that mismatch when you start seeing little issues.
Right. That's so cool. I know you've mentioned that, I'm sure, in the last 2 years of working with you, but it's such a good example. Even if, you know, examples are never perfect in science, it's a really good way to kind of hit the point home.
There's always lots of other factors, but the thought is it could be related to that.
So to answer your particular research question, you subjected parent fish to cycling temperature and hypoxia stressors. So hypoxia being low oxygen. And then you measured certain biological molecules in both the mothers and their offspring. Why did you choose cycling stressors in particular? And what makes that setup different than previous studies?
So previous studies typically use static stressors, so that would be holding conditions steady throughout the entire exposure period. So these would be things for either temperature, hypoxia, or some kind of combination of the two, be relatively rare, but it does happen. And while I don't want to knock those, because they're very important for establishing what the kind of effects you might see when you start manipulating things like the length of the exposure and if you want to cycle or not, like I did, I think we're at that stage where we need to step beyond that and try to represent what's seen in natural environments more accurately, I would suppose. And this kind of ties back into another answer I had earlier, where it's almost like a natural progression of what I was doing. So in my master's, we were looking at the impacts of incubation temperature on lake and round whitefish embryos, how it impacted them across time. So previously, they've been studied at constant temperatures, but I was thinking, well, clearly they're responding in the fall and temperatures drop, and then they maintain temperature and they increase. So why don't we replicate that? And so by doing that, I was seeing different changes in the vulnerable time and hatching and survival. So it was almost a natural progression to, well, if I did that in a long time scale across like 6 months, why don't we do this at a shorter time scale and see the change across every day?
Okay, so for the audience, the cycles mimicked how temperature and oxygen fluctuate throughout the day, like with sun versus when the sun sets. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the fish that you used in your study are zebrafish. Can you tell us a bit about these fish in particular and why you chose them for your study? I know that people in zebrafish work will be like, oh, well, of course. But for those outside of the field, what makes them particularly suited to what you were looking at?
So zebrafish have quite a long history when it comes to being used as a research model. Well, relatively young. They're shallow tropical water fish from native to India and like other southern areas, so like Myanmar, Bangladesh, that kind of region. And they typically experience high temperatures and possibly low dissolved oxygen levels throughout the day, depending on what time of day you're sampling them. So they are particularly well used for study in that kind of almost like a positive happenstance, because they were essentially just a fun little zebrafish, like aquarium kind of fish you could get at a pet shop. And so they were used for study like decades and decades ago. And it wasn't only because of the continued study on them for different things like behavior and neurogenesis and that kind of thing that they really kind of took off and ended up being used in not just what I'm doing for environmental stress, but also for like human research, because they have a lot of similar responses as humans do and a lot of similar genes.
So you mentioned that zebrafish experience a wide range of temperatures natively. Could this mean that temperature fluctuation would actually be less of a stressor for this species?
So this kind of comes down to what you want to call a stressor. Mm. So is something stressful because you have the triggering of certain hormones related to stress, like say producing glucocorticoids or producing heat shock proteins? Or is something stressful because you actually have like cellular DNA damage, in which case you then have to repair And so it's more replicable of requiring HSBs. So it's a bit tricky in that regard. You can say anything that deviates from homeostasis. So for homeostasis, for the audience who may be unfamiliar with the term, it essentially is when you're maintaining this kind of like set range where you want to hover around, which is ideal for you. So think of it kind of like your thermostat, that kind of thing where you set a temperature you want to maintain around there. So you've deviated too far, so say like a really hot day and temperature's really high, then it might be stressful that you're far outside of where you want to be and you have to kind of rein yourself back in. So even though they might experience it natively, it doesn't mean they want to be stressed per se, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. That makes a lot of sense.
It's a area of concern in the field of stress, of how we want to define stress. So I don't want to say that they are or not stressed. It just it comes into how you want to define.
Once again, running into language
yes.
trickiness in science.
So in these zebrafish, you measured glucocorticoids, mm-hmm. which are stress hormones, and heat stress proteins. So how did you choose to focus on those when thinking about temperature regulation and hypoxia or low oxygen?
So I chose to study glucocorticoids. So those involve things like cortisol. So they've gotten kind of the nickname or the moniker like stress hormone, just because they're produced when you're stressed because they have a bunch of roles that are related to helping you deal with that stress. So for example, cortisol can help mobilize your energy stores, like having more glucose, so you can consume fuel more readily versus than its other forms. It also will stop your energy being shunted towards, you know, non-essential processes. Like if you're in the middle of a fight, you don't necessarily need to be thinking about, oh, I really got to grow, or oh, I really got to prepare to reproduce later on. You're focused more about, do I have the energy to fight or escape this particular stressful scenario? Likewise, heat shock proteins are also produced very commonly following a stressor. It's not just heat, like the name implies, but a wide variety of things, including hypoxia or low oxygen, and like radiation and high salt and drought, all those kind of stressors can also increase heat shock protein levels. So keeping those two kind of groups of compounds that are typically increased following stress, I figured, okay, so we have these stressors, let's compare things that are commonly seen in climate change freshwater environments, so high temperature and low oxygen, which are also come like, well, not just climate change, but also known to increase both cortisol as a glucocorticoid and heat shock protein. So it's kind of a scouring the literature and seeing what fit and made sense for my model.
So you found differences in how glucocorticoids are metabolized, which basically means broken down. And you were able to find some differences in how they're metabolized in the whole body of the zebrafish compared with just the ovary, which was interesting to you because of the, reproduction angle. So why would you think that something like cortisol metabolism would be different between ovaries and the whole body?
So I didn't measure the metabolites, or rather metabolism enzymes, in the whole body, just at the gills. So the gills are kind of exposed literally to the water, which are having the high temperature and the low oxygen literally being exposed to them. Whereas the ovaries are kind of more central and they have different kind of proportions of different types of cells and macronutrients. So that could also impact of how much is stored in each one. And then another thing to keep in mind is that for these metabolites, I was looking at, or not metabolites, these metabolizing enzymes, I was only looking at gene expression. So gene expression, for those listening, it's a kind of, not really a quick way, but an easy way to compare different levels of certain targets you're looking for when you're doing these kinds of studies. But they don't necessarily translate to what you've seen in real life. So imagine it being like a recipe card. So you might see a lot of recipe cards in an area, but if no one takes the recipe cards and actually makes food with them, then it doesn't mean anything. You just have a bunch of cards lying around that don't do anything. So usually it's not quite... You know, you have a lot of recipe cards and nothing happens. It's more of a one-to-one or at least a proportional ratio. But just a caution that we've not necessarily seen impacts. So like when I was measuring 20 beta hydrocortisone, which is a breakdown product from cortisone and cortisone from cortisol, we didn't see any differences, even though we did see differences in the enzymes responsible for converting cortisol.
Interesting. Right. So for the listener, I really love your recipe card analogy. Basically, cells will make gene transcripts, which are the recipe cards, in response to, you know, some stimulus. And then those transcripts are turned into proteins, or the food in Michael's analogy. So there are different things that you can measure when doing a study like this.
And then take an analogy even one step further. It's, you can have the proteins, but it doesn't stop there. It depends on if you actually use them or not. So it's kind of like, is anyone eating the food? Does it make is it going to do anything in the end?
Yeah, yeah. It does get quite muddy when you talk about subcellular processes like this. So very, very interesting thing to keep in mind about, you know, what does all of this mean for the actual fish?
So thinking about your results, did you find notable differences in how glucocorticoids were passed down compared to how heat stress proteins were passed down? Did you see differences or no differences that you expected?
So I guess I'll tackle the heat stress proteins first, because that was something more what you'd expect, where there were increased levels of heat stress proteins in stress parents, particularly those exposed to my high temperature cycling regime, that with or without hypoxia. And then you saw increased levels of HR proteins in the embryos. So you kind of dust your hands off, like, we did it. We have a collection right there, increased levels in the mother, increased levels in the offspring. We did it. Here's the information. So when we looked at glucocorticoids, so in terms of cortisol, contrary to a lot of work in not fish species, which is typically see an increased amount of cortisol being deposited, we saw increments of cortisol in the mothers, but then we saw decreased levels in the offspring. So the complete opposite. So that was really surprising, but in later studies in my thesis, which we're not talking about today, obviously, but it showed that was very consistent, that this is not just a one-off thing, but they were consistently having lower cortisol levels. So clearly this is something that not only highlights potential differences between species, let's say just not even just fish and humans, but, you know, it's good to have an open mind, I guess. But taking unexpected results.
If it's not predictable, at least it's consistent.
In hindsight, that's true. The research is a little more varied in terms of if you see increased cortisol or not in fish. But at the time, a lot of the work had really been pushing for we would see an increase.
So you found that hypoxia causes a decrease in reproductive success, which seems fairly intuitive, but you also saw that elevated temperatures saw some aspects of reproductive success go up and others go down. So what did you measure in terms of like your endpoints there?
Yeah, so reproduction, I was measuring just literally the amount of eggs per female. Mm-hmm. So and then we also measured viability, so the percent surviving at 1 hour. So yes, we did have lower quality in terms of the actual amount of survival. And in another study, I'm just like dropping all these things for future studies, but in another study that's coming out soon, we also measured size. So we see differences in size of embryos as well. So there's this clearly potentially a thing going on here in terms of reproductive impact, but that's for another podcast, I guess.
You observed an increase in egg number, but a decrease in egg viability.
Yes, just in the cycling temperature compared to, I think, cycling hypoxia, but there's actually no difference compared to the controls.
So thinking about your conclusions and moving forward, it's interesting to think about how mothers can pass on information about their environment to their offspring at a subcellular level. But we all know it takes two to tango. As you said earlier, maybe the like parental hypothesis. So could you speculate on what the father's contribution may be in this scenario of environmental stress?
Sure. So for better or worse, as you can probably imagine, people are usually more interested in studying what it means for humans. And so for a human context and mammals, where you have the mother literally carrying the child throughout the entire developmental period. So what the mother's passing on is more, I guess, important and impactful across time. Versus other species that are oviparous, so in other words, egg-laying species like fish, may not necessarily have any impact on development and care after being laid. And so all the information is all deposited at that moment of fertilization. And so work on oviparous species has suggested that the impact of father is actually more important than you might expect. So one angle is in terms of epigenetic modifications. So that's, for those who are unfamiliar, epigenetic modifications are essentially changes to how your genes express themselves without actually changing your genome itself. So a common thing we might see is like DNA methylation, which can impact how much your genes are actually expressed. So this can be inherited both from your mother and through your father. But more recent work in fish has shown that, for example, in zebrafish, I believe, the maternal DNA methylation pattern, that can be just scrubbed out and they keep the paternal. And so we have the instances across the paternal line in different fish species across generations where this consistent impact seen through that line. So not to say that one gender is more important than the other, but rather they probably have different contributions and should be able to be studied.
Yeah, that's a really cool distinction that I think we're so biased as mammals towards, like, the mother contribution.
I mean, like, I get it. You're a funder. You're like, oh, humans, I understand that. I'm going to fund that. And so that's how it works. But
yeah, and even in other egg-laying species, like you think of birds, oftentimes the mother does have more, you know, contribution to the care post-laying. Like you picture, you know, a chicken sitting on her eggs. But that's not the case for fish, certainly. So very cool.
Wild, crazily in fish. Like for zebrafish, they do nothing. But some other fish species, like the mother leaves and says, good luck. And the father's on to take care of all the eggs. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, fanning a nest and all that kind of thing. So it all depends on your species. But yes, it's highly variable out there in nature.
Yeah. So on that note a little bit, do you think that this research is applicable to other fish or other types of animals, given all these this diversity?
I kind of feel like I'm contradicting myself, but although there is a huge amount of diversity, there's also a lot of conservation for certain things. So like the causal stress response and heat shock protein stress response, they're quite well preserved, so that I would not be surprised to see if we saw similar stress patterns being inherited across different species. Of course, it could differ depending on the type of stress you're using and how, I guess, going back to that idea of how stressed an animal is by your stressor, could change the levels that are actually increased or not in your parents. But in general, yes, I think we can be looking at these two different pathways as something to look forward for stress transfer across generations.
So to touch on more of, I would say, a human aspect of it, what was your favorite part of the research project?
This is always a tough question. And whenever I ask this to people too, when I was on a podcast, like, it's always fun to see what they come up with. But being in the hot seat now, it's really hard to pick something. I always get that answer, but it's true, because there's so many different things that you think about, like, normally when you get your first paper out, for example, when you get your first major finding, or like when you get to present at a conference, all the things are really great and they're fun. I think I'll go back to an answer I've heard before. I feel kind of bad. I can't remember their name right now, but I remember asking them what they really, really enjoyed about their work. And it was, they were saying that first moment when you are running an assay or you are running that statistical test and you see that difference, and you're the only person in the world in that moment that knows something, that's like pretty like mind-blowing. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like that moment you're the only person that has that kind of knowledge, that's like seeing a new thing for the first time.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. I mean, yeah, seeing the output of a test and seeing that p-value and sort of a little mini firework goes off. You're like, ooh, that's so exciting.
So the best ones, you do like a colorimetric test or something, so you can literally see the impact like right away.
Oh yeah,
I did it. Something happened.
Yeah, you see that color change, and it's so much more tangible than my
just
example.
Just another zero. Like, oh. Yeah. Once you've been in science enough, no. Don't let me knock that. Once you're in science enough, you get that extra zero in there. You're like, oh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did you have any surprising moments? And if you did you have a most surprising part of the research?
So I guess we kind of talked about it before, but like the most surprising thing was seeing that complete flip in terms of the cortisol being transferred. That was you know, just because I've been so focused on the other literature in the in that kind of realm before, in terms of mammals and looking at birds and seeing increased GC transfer or glucocorticoid transfer, that was pretty shocking. I think that was probably the biggest surprise for me, and having to figure out why later on.
Yeah, that's probably a combination of those two moments of the first time that you found that out, being excited and so surprised at the same time.
I think my first thought wasn't happiness. It was, oh God, did I do this wrong?
Right. and then it turned out to be consistent.
Yep, turned out to be consistent. So it definitely wasn't I messed up like the labels of the different treatments. It was definitely a very consistent effect.
Yeah.
So if you could have, if we could get you to travel through time and go back, and you could change one thing about this study, what would you change and why?
So I don't want to throw the mass spec facility under the bus, but I really wish that we had just used professional services or just like given it all to a technician just to do, instead of trying to like do it like half on our own and then trying to run it through the mass spec facility downstairs. I literally wasted years trying to get that to work, just like putting samples in and then things would either break down or someone occupy it for some time and you come back and suddenly the exact same settings you used before don't work anymore. It was literally that for years, and then the pandemic happened. So it just kept going on and on. It was like, when we came back from the pandemic, like, no, this is it, forget it, we're done, we're just gonna give it to a professional service, they'll do it, the whole thing, front to end, and that's how we got that data. But yes, I would go back in time and say, Michael, just forget it. It's not gonna happen.
So last but not least, what do you hope this work will do for the field or the general public?
So for the field, I hope it just kind of strengthens that notion that you keep your mind open in terms of studying not just the beaten path in terms of just cortisol, for example, and expecting a certain outcome, but also looking at other things. Like for heat shock proteins, they haven't really been super well tied into looking at stress across generations, and I'm seeing a pretty consistent effect across my studies, so showing the importance of that. And also, of course, looking at more naturally relevant conditions. We're at that stage where we can do that. We can kind of mix things, have different stressors, change across time, mix them all together, all that kind of thing, I think is the way of the future. As for the general public, I would say the jury is out on if animals can cope with climate change or not. We may not be quite so doom and gloom as we initially thought, in terms of being much more rapid, that can happen with natural selection, and that perhaps we shouldn't knock Lamarck so harshly for his idea that there could be influences across generations. For those who may be less familiar, hopefully you talked about the same example like in your maybe high school biology, where Lamarck was a famous biologist, or I guess evolutionary biologist, who talked about how giraffes grew really long necks because their ancestors had stretched out and had long necks and is kind of like proliferated across time. And so perhaps it's not quite so cut and dry as that. There's probably more influence of both natural selection and those kind of ideas, but perhaps he was onto something after all with this field of epigenetics.
Use it or lose it. That was his motto, I remember from school. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for coming back after, you know, graduating and moving on to exciting things. You're still giving us your time, so I really appreciate it.
I remember back on Scribe fondly, so I'm happy to come back and do something.
So that brings us to the end of today's podcast. A big thanks again to our guest, Dr. Michael Lim, for joining us today. GriffinCast is brought to you by your hosts, Amanda Reside, and me, Mackenzie Charter. If you're hungry to learn about more science topics, check out Scribe Research Highlights, that's SCRIBE Research Highlights, on the University of Guelph website at uoguelph.ca, or you can follow us on social media at U of G CBS, Find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Music in the podcast comes from Upbeat. Details are in our show notes. And until next time, stay curious.